Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yeah, it's Jobs Day on a Friday, everybody, so we will start there. We will segue smoothly into space tourism and end, yes, with Greek yogurt. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 2nd of May today. Great to have you with us, everybody. It was a big day today, big week, actually, economy-wise, so we are going to get right to it. Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post and John Carney from The Wall Street Journal are here to review with us the week that was. Hey, guys.
Hi, Kai.
So, Catherine, we will start with the jobs report today. 288,000 new jobs, 6.3% is the unemployment rate. Good, yes?
Yeah, I mean, generally, this was a very good report. It brought up the average jobs growth that we've seen in the last year. You know, it was much stronger than we've seen in the last few months. Some of that may be a rebound from the severe winter weather mm-hmm. that we had earlier this year. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you kind of got to take it with a grain of salt. But generally speaking, it was a pretty positive report.
John, to Catherine's point about reconciling it with the lousy weather, we had gross domestic product that came out earlier this week for the first quarter, which was by any measure lousy, a 10%. How do you reconcile this and that?
I think that's right in that we had a very slow first quarter, and that may have built up a lot of demand for both goods and for jobs. You know, employers didn't get hiring done. Weather started to improve. People started to shop. So things could be a lot better than people thought they would be in the second quarter because they were so bad in the first quarter.
Yeah. Catherine, I want to get just a teeny-weeny bit down in the weeds on this jobs report. That 6.3% was in no small measure because fewer people are in the labor force. Is that troubling to you, or is that just kind of the new normal now?
I think it is distressing when you see that the unemployment rate fell because people dropped out of the labor force rather than because people who were unemployed actually got new jobs.
Right. That's a key point, actually. Right.
That's a really
key point. Yeah.
Right. That it's very important. And you would expect that this far into a recovery, you would actually see the labor force participation rate increasing somewhat as mm-hmm. people who were sitting on the sidelines maybe decided to dip a toe back into the job market and start hunting for a job again, even, you know, aside from the fact that the population is aging and people are retiring and that sort of thing. But yeah, it's discouraging. You know, but again, bear in mind that those numbers tend to be very noisy. The survey that the unemployment rate comes from is much noisier, you know, has a much bigger margin of error than that the payroll growth number comes from. So, you know, it's discouraging, but we could very well see a huge bounce back in terms of the household number next month.
So, John, speaking of huge bounce backs, I heard a guy say on the radio today, you could see 4% economic growth if these numbers hold in the second and third quarter of this year. Do you buy that?
No, okay. I think that's way too optimistic. I think that a lot of economists, including those at the Federal Reserve, are going to wind up bringing down their estimates for the year based on how weak the first quarter was. And there are still signs of weakness. I want to say just a few moments ago, J.P. Morgan Chase came out and said they expect their market's revenue to be down 20%. That's a sign that there's still some slowness, sluggishness in the economy.
Well, I'll tell you what, you guys are feeding me my next questions today. The Fed did meet this week. They came out on, what, Wednesday afternoon, Catherine, and said, yeah, you know, nothing to see here. Move on. We're going to keep doing what we've doing. Any reason at all that today's report changes what the Fed may or may not be doing?
I don't think so. I think that even though the overall payroll growth number was stronger mm-hmm. than people had been expecting, it wasn't so, so wildly gangbusters, so wildly great that it seems likely, that the Fed is suddenly going to start raising interest rates or anything like that. There's still substantial slack in the labor market. You still have a lot of people who are unemployed. You still have a very high share of unemployed people who have been out of work for over 6 months. Those are people who are even harder to get back into jobs. So it kind of seems like not much change, not much that we know about the the economy really change today. So if the Fed decided on Wednesday that it was going to stay the course, I'm not sure that its thinking was really affected by today's report substantially.
And also, you know, Janet Yellen probably had these numbers on Wednesday.
Right. I think the Fed's communication earlier in the week actually kind of presaged a lot of this, because what they said is we've seen a pickup in recent weeks, and this is what they saw. This is the pickup.
John Carney from The Wall Street Journal, Catherine Rampell from The Washington Post. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks
a lot.
Have a good weekend. All right. So on Wall Street today, which we did not talk about, by the by, tepid, I guess you'd say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. This was, as John, Catherine, and I were talking about, a generally good jobs report with a couple of not insignificant caveats. Here's another one for you. Wages didn't budge last month. They went down, in fact, in April, and they have grown precious little over the past 5 years. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore explains why and when that might change.
Bethany Bray worked as a newspaper reporter in New England. Her experience may sound familiar.
My last raise was in 2007. Going for that long without a pay increase, it was tough. It was tough.
When you factor in inflation, which has been very low but still present, wages have barely kept up. In fact, this past month, they didn't keep up at all. So why haven't employers increased pay much? Well, why should they?
Employers did not feel it was necessary to significantly raise wages at a time when the pool of unemployed was so large.
That's Bernie Baumol, chief economist at the Economic Outlook Group. If there's a line of people outside who want your job, you're going to think twice about asking for a raise. Now, Bethany Bray, the writer, she eventually did get a raise. Here's how.
I left.
She got a new job. And that's what it will take for wages to increase further. Heidi Shierholz is with the Economic Policy Institute.
If we get an extended period of really strong jobs growth, that's when we'll start to see wage growth pick up.
The more alternatives a worker has, the more pressure he or she can put on an employer.
I think we are seeing this to a limited extent now.
Alan Krueger is an economist at Princeton University. He says there's one kind of sad reason wages aren't inching up. A lot of unemployed people have either given up or have been out of work for so long they aren't as appealing to employers. That line of people outside waiting to take your job, it's not looking quite as good. So it's a little easier to get a raise. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
It's just gotten harder in the state of Georgia to apply for a certain kind of welfare benefit, the kind that comes in the form of monthly cash assistance. Specifically, Governor Nathan Deal has signed legislation that will require people to take drug tests before they can apply. Georgia is just the latest of more than a dozen states that have either proposed or are trying out similar statutes, in theory, to save money. Marketplace's Noel King has that story.
We don't know how much money, if any, states are saving. What we do know is that the drug tests do not appear to be catching many drug users. Elizabeth Lauerbach is with the Center for Law and Social Policy.
In Oklahoma, 29 people were denied benefits out of 1,300. And then Utah, 12 people failed out of 4,730.
But advocates of drug testing say it's also about deterring those who would otherwise apply for benefits. Taryn Bragdon is CEO of the Foundation for Government Accountability, a conservative think tank.
By having the testing requirement in place, you screen out individuals who have a drug addiction, who never go through the process to begin with because they know they won't receive benefits.
And it's much harder to count those people. But not everyone agrees that deterrence is the best thing for needy families. Again, Elizabeth Lauerbach.
These are very poor families and they have children. You don't want to scare them off and have them not getting help. You want the kids getting the help so they can have clothes and housing. And you want the parents getting treatment so they can get jobs and be better parents. Scaring them off is a terrible outcome.
Many welfare researchers agree that drug tests are sometimes necessary. But mass testing can cost a state money. In 2011, Florida required welfare applicants to pay for their own drug tests. More than 97% passed, and the state had to reimburse them to the tune of more than $100,000. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
You know how when you want to go someplace, vacation, maybe, you get online, you buy your tickets, or you book your resort of choice, no travel agent needed. Well, travel of the future, by which I mean space, is going to be a little bit more complicated, at least in the short term. Virgin Galactic says it could be sending tourists into Earth orbit as soon as the end of this year. But you can't book that kind of thing yourself. From KPCC, Sandon Totten explains how it's going to work.
Jay Johnson likes to say he has the ultimate icebreaker.
When you walk into a cocktail party and somebody asks you what you do for a living, well, I sell trips to space. Wait, say what?
Johnson runs Coastline Travel Advisors in Southern California. He's also a Virgin Galactic ASA, or Accredited Space Agent. That means he's one of just 91 people around the world chosen to sell tickets for Virgin Galactic's upcoming space tourism experience.
Look at that picture. Look at that. How cool is that?
He shows me a giant picture book he uses during sales pitches.
The cockpit, what it's going to look like. Guys floating around, taking pictures.
The plan is to have 6 tourists at a time ride up in Virgin's ship, which looks like a space-age Learjet. It'll rocket up to suborbit, where passengers will float around weightlessly for a few minutes before returning to Earth. Johnson makes a commission on each ticket, but it's small compared to most vacation packages he sells. So far, he's booked 8 seats. Now, that may not sound like a lot, but keep in mind, each seat sells for $250,000. Finding buyers hasn't been easy.
In the early stages, nobody knew how to market this. We had no clue who the clients would be.
That's Linda Turley Garrett, an accredited space agent in the Bay Area. She's tried marketing at everything from science museums to luxury car dealers. Between the two of them, Turley Garrett and Johnson have sold to a techie from Silicon Valley, a real estate broker from Columbus, a 70-year-old South Korean retiree, and a few celebrities who wish to remain anonymous.
Even talking about it, I get excited about it.
Josh Resnick is a video game developer from Brentwood, California. He bought 2 tickets from Jay Johnson, one for himself and another for his mom, Retta.
Such an opportunity. I just jumped on it.
They've been waiting 7 years and counting for Virgin to finally start flying to space. But 79-year-old Retta says that wait is nothing.
When I was born, there was no television. There was no real washing machines. And yes, there was horse and buggy that delivered ice to our house for our icebox. So we've come a long way.
But we're not there yet, says Greg Autry, an expert on the private space industry. He says even though Virgin Galactic has sold more than 700 tickets, it still hasn't made a profit.
They can't really count the deposits till they've delivered on the service.
And he says while there are a few other companies eager to enter the space tourism business, the industry can't really rocket off until there's more competition.
No industry exists in a bubble, and there have to be all sorts of other companies supplying them with things like fuel, logistical services, pre-flight training for their astronauts, spacesuits, and materials.
The price would also need to drop a lot before summer vacations to space are a mainstream thing. Back at his office, space agent Jay Johnson is following up with a potential customer.
Hi, I'm trying to reach Jeff. Is he available?
He says, for now, he'll keep working the phones, showing up at travel expos, and scouring Southern California for people with a dream of flying to space and a couple $100,000 to spare. In Los Angeles, I'm Sandon Totten for Marketplace.
Coming up,
yogurt companies are just looking for ways to keep consumers interested in buying yogurt.
It is not just for breakfast anymore, y'all. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 45 points on this Friday. That's 0.25%, closed at 16,512. The NASDAQ off 2 points, about 0.1%, ended things at 4,123. The S&P 500 off 2 points, 0.1%. Finished at 1881. For the week that was, the Dow gained 0.9%. The NASDAQ was up 1.2%. The S&P 500 gained 0.9% as well. Merck moved down 2.33%. The pharmaceutical giant is stopping trials of a cancer drug it was developing with biopharma company Endocyte. Endocyte tumbled 62% on that news. Pfizer flopped 1.25% on this Friday after British drug company AstraZeneca rejected its latest buyout offer. AstraZeneca down about 0.1%. LinkedIn off 8.33%. The social networking service said yesterday its second quarter revenue would fall short of expectations. Wynn Resorts flooded up 7.33% after Wynn Macau's first quarter profits beat estimates. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note off to 2.58%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Monday, Cinco de Mayo. Pfizer is scheduled to release quarterly earnings. The legendary Carnegie Hall opened in New York City on May 5th, 1891. And singer-songwriter Adele turns 26. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. There has been much talk of income inequality lately. President Obama, congressional leaders, economists of varying stripes have all been engaged on that issue. An outgrowth, it seems reasonable to say, of Occupy Wall Street and the days when the 1% and the 99% were very much in the vernacular. There is some new research out, actually, some surprising new research, I should say, about that 1%. Our wealth and poverty reporter Chrissy Clark has been looking into it.
Back when we were hearing a lot of this chant. A guy named Mark Rank started paying attention to the assumptions that seemed to be buried in that chant. Who exactly was the 99%? And what was their relationship to that increasingly notorious 1%? The whole debate struck Rank as very us versus them.
That they are static groups, and there's that image out there that, you know, those two groups do not cross over.
Rank is a professor of social welfare at Washington University, and he decided to see if this static image of the 1% and everyone else was true. In a new book called Chasing the American Dream, Rank and a colleague looked at four decades of data that followed the lives of thousands of Americans to see how much money they made each year. And what they found surprised them.
There actually is this really strong sense of fluidity in terms of folks entering the top income percentiles.
The Top Earners Club isn't quite the bastioned, unreachable world that it's been painted out to be. According to Rank's research, one in five Americans are in the 2% at some point in their lives, and one in eight spend at least a year in the 1%. So who are they?
Hi. Nice to meet you, too. Hello.
Some might be your neighbors.
We don't want the neighbors to know what we have in here. They don't know. No one knows.
Barrett Aretsian lives in a totally nondescript condo in Glendale, California, the same one he grew up in. As a kid, he was solidly middle class. His mom owned a little Armenian bookstore. Money was sometimes tight. He was on scholarships at UCLA and then struggling to make it as a songwriter and producer. But then, a few years ago, this song he wrote in his bedroom... It's called Jar of Hearts, and it got played on the TV show So You Think You Can Dance.
No, I can't take one more step towards you.
It was a hit, a big hit.
And everything changed.
Including his income. That year, Aretsian catapulted into the 1%, but he tries not to live like he has.
Don't get me wrong, I go to Hawaii every year, and I pretty much financially am in a very comfortable position. I think that's the big difference, is you just have that comfort.
For another recent arrival to the 1%, an iPhone app developer named Jason Lawn, the surprising thing about being at the top is that it doesn't always feel like the top.
The 1%ers we think of, you know, spend $10,000 on a commode. If you're making $340,000, you're not going to waste $10,000 on something like that.
Lon says he actually asked his accountant about trying to make some smart financial decisions, taking advantage of tax loopholes, things like that. And his accountant told him he wasn't rich enough.
You're not connected enough to try to hide your assets in such a way. You can't afford the overhead.
Another thing about the new research about the 1%, one in eight Americans might visit the 1% for a year, but only one in 100 stay there for more than a decade. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
Greek yogurt's been all the rage for a good couple of years now, but I'm going to guess it's mostly been a breakfast thing for you, right? Chobani, however, has designs on lunch and dinner as well. The market leader in the Greek yogurt space, a phrase I never thought you would hear me say on the radio, has decided it needs to expand. Vanessa Wong from Bloomberg Businessweek has been surveying the field, if you will. Vanessa, nice to have you with us.
Great to be here. Thanks, Kai.
Why is Chobani so desperate to not just be for breakfast anymore? I don't get it. You know, yogurt for breakfast is good.
Yeah, yogurt for breakfast totally makes sense, but that's like too old school now. So Chobani's playing part of what the restaurant industry calls like a day part competition.
Oh, man. It's like media and day parts. Holy cow.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So Chobani's launching a slew of new products that includes other categories that you can eat later in the day.
Like what?
Or that make more sense for you later
well,
in the day.
I'm trying to conceive of that. What would that be?
Yeah. So they have a kind of pudding-like dessert. But the interesting thing to me is the cooking ingredients. Chobani actually has a cafe in New York.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about this. You went, right? And
I went to, yeah, it's a really beautiful cafe. It's in Soho. They have like lots of nice seating and an open kitchen where you can order kind of unusual products made with Greek yogurt.
So what'd you have? Well, no, hold on. What'd you have?
I ordered a smoked salmon bagel with a cream cheese made with yogurt. So that was kind of interesting. I didn't know that yogurt could be used as a cream cheese substitute. And they also have kind of savory yogurt mixes. So I got one with mango and avocado on top of plain Chobani yogurt. And then there was another with pesto and tomato and like pine nuts on it, which was really good and surprising.
I totally get the business imperative for Chobani to become something else, especially in a space as crowded as Greek yogurt has become. But that's kind of the question, right? Has Greek yogurt now, when you're putting avocado and whatever on it, has it not kind of jumped the shark?
Yeah, Greek yogurt is still kind of the exciting growth area in the yogurt market. However, it is starting to slow. Yogurt companies are just looking for ways to keep consumers interested in buying yogurt, more yogurt all the time.
Always. It's always more all the time. The yogurt business. Vanessa Wong at Bloomberg Businessweek. Vanessa, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai.
Finally, on a Friday, it's movie time. The latest superhero mega franchise hits the multiplex today. The Amazing Spider-Man 2 opens nationwide. And it's safe to say that Sony Pictures is hoping for amazing business at the box office. That, however, may be a challenge for Spidey. This was a very expensive movie to make, and the critics thus far have not been kind. Here's Marketplace's Jeff Tyler on just how unsinkable superhero franchises might really be.
Sony has a lot riding on this Spider-Man flick. It sets up two separate spin-off movies, plus the third and fourth installments of the Spider-Man franchise.
You know what it is I love about being Spider-Man? Everything.
Critics and audiences are showing less love for the superhero.
It is the worst Spider-Man movie that I have personally seen.
Jeff Snyder is a reporter for the entertainment news website TheWrap.com. Despite the critical reception of the movie, it's already made more than $150 million overseas. Snyder expects Spider-Man 2 will be a modest commercial success.
I think Sony is hoping that this movie will gross $1 billion, and I don't think that that's going to happen.
Albert Ching is an editor at Comic Book Resources, which covers all things related to comic books. He says Sony may have rebooted the Spider-Man franchise too quickly.
Part of it just might be some amount of fatigue from the audience. This is going to be the fifth Spider-Man movie in 12 years.
Audience fatigue isn't the only issue. Jeff Snyder at The Wrap says Sony needs to please investors, too.
Sony has come under fire from its investors, namely Daniel Loeb, who's like a big hedge fund guru.
Sony doesn't have many other franchises like Spider-Man, so if this version of the web slinger doesn't stick with audiences, expect investors to press for changes at the studio. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, in which the surveillance society appears to go just a step too far, a company named Quantified Toilets announced this week it would be installing smart toilets at the convention center in the city of Toronto, Canada. To quote from their literature, using advanced sensing technologies and a state-of-the-art centralized waste data collection system, we are able to discreetly capture data from each individual toilet. And, well, it goes on. It was also, sadly, just a hoax, a sort of interactive experiment at a conference in Toronto this week about, wait for it, human factors in computing. TMI, right? Just TMI. Nobody wants to know that stuff. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Today on Wall Street, the Dow off 45 points, about a 0.25%, closed at 16,512. The NASDAQ slipped 3 points, about a 0.1%, ended things at 4,123. The S&P 500 off 2 points, a 0.1%, finished at 1,881. Good week, though, all the way around on all three major indices. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace was developed by J.J. Yord, is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We'll see you, on Monday, I guess. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.